Hello, hello.
Hello. What was that? Okay, today we're going to talk about pen testing, moving from art to science. Of the people in here, how many people have an interest in pen testing or do pen testing? So, wow, a lot of people, a lot of people. Well, the thing is, pen testers, frankly, we have a lot of problems. There's no real repeatability between tests. You have one tester do a test, you have another tester do a test, even the same tester. If I do the same test twice, the fact I'm going to get the same results, I mean, that's not even guaranteed. That's a big problem in terms of, providing useful results to our clients. It also then produces inconsistent results. Again, the results that we're producing, you'd have the same person or multiple people run the same test, you still get different results each time. And that just, leads up to the third one of, it provides really limited value to our clients, and really, degrades the whole testing process. So the key thing here is we really need measurable and consistent and repeatable results. In order to have the results be useful, they really have to be measurable, consistent, and repeatable. And this brings us to goal-based pen testing. And really, the big thing with goal-based pen testing is knowing your client, because each person is going to have a different need based off of the type of person they are. So look at the business person. What are some of the business person's requirements, for a pen test when it comes down to it? The first big one, price. Price is a big thing that is one of the big drivers of business. Other would be compliance requirements. Are there requirements around the compliance requirements around the use and test results to make sure that those fit their needs? So you get into this and you get into stuff like the archive quality results. Are they producing products that are archive quality? Do they have anti-check washing features? That could be something that could be of interest to a business person. And then, finally, want to make sure leak resistance is very important. Business people very concerned about appearance need to make sure products that are leak resistant. And then ease of use. You have a large business environment where you're going to have a wide range of people, so you really need ease of use so that the whole population can use it. So what are some other requirements? Let's look at another large group, drafters and designers. And for them, they're also going to have requirements of, things like ease of use. Again, needs to be something, this is a tool they're using every day. Needs to be something that is easy to use and also has a good feel. And if you're, spending 8 hours a day using something, needs to fit very well, work very well, consistent line quality, consistent line width, line consistency, again, very important. Smudge resistance to make sure that patterns aren't smudged, lines aren't smudged is just critical. And then also the ability to do fine detail is also just of the utmost importance for drafters and designers. Third group we'll look at are artists. For artists, consistent results, again, critical. This is their lifeblood that they're working on here. Needs to make sure they're consistent results. Smooth operation, if you're using it on a daily basis, has to operate smoothly. The feel is just critical. Ease of control, being able to easily control the flow, the design is just critical. Solid colors, and then finally fade resistance. If you're working on a piece for hours on end and then 5 years later the pattern fades, you're going to have a really pissed off customer, spend a lot of money on a piece of artwork that's then starting to fade. So now that we talk about kind of some of the goals there, the next big thing is let's figure out how we got here. So with that, we're going to go through a history of pens, kind of talk about how it is we got here and what the problem is. 3000 BC, first evidence of reed-based pens being used. This was in the first dynasty in China. And on the picture there is an example of how a reed-based pen is used. They basically take a reed, which is a hollow plant, carve out the tip, carve it down to make a proper size. They dip it into ink. The ink actually gets sucked up into the pen, and then they write and need to keep on dipping. That was the first recorded use of pens. Then 500 BC was the first actually written reference to pens inside literature, and that came out of India. And it's interesting to see how, you know, some of the technology has spread throughout the world. And then 100 BC, the quill-based pen became popular in Europe. And the quill-based pen, I want to take a chance to just focus on for a minute here, because this really became the pen standard for, you know, pretty much most of, you know, the pen's life has been the quill-based pen. Really, even up into, you know, the 18th and 19th century, the quill-based pen, or similarities of it, were basically the, you know, very popularly used. So to make this, you start out with a tail feather from a goose or another large bird. Would again trim it down similar to a reed feather, reed pen. And again, ink was stored inside the pen. You dip it in, also called dipping pens. And then write, dip. 79 AD, big invention came through. We started to see evidence of copper metal nibs being used in Rome. Actually, in the ruins of Pompeii, they found copper metal nibs, which is the first case we've seen of moving away from quill-based pens or bamboo or reed-based over to using metal. So in this case, you actually use copper to form the nib of the pen, which is the part that writes. Another key item is 105 AD, the modern paper process was invented in China, where you used rags or plant fibers to make paper. Before then, people wrote on things like just straight wood, rocks, pounded down plant particles, but they didn't actually follow the normal paper process that we see today. And this process actually started to migrate over to Europe. First, during the battle of, there was a battle between the Chinese Empire and the Islamic Empire at the time at Talas. And basically when the Arabs defeated the Chinese, one of the things that had occurred is as they moved into that area, they got access to paper-making technology, which was very restricted up until then, and that then allowed it to flow into the Middle East and eventually up into Europe. So then the 1953, first recorded record of a pen which held ink inside occurred, and this is actually where ink was stored inside. It's still not a perfected design. So we move on, we actually get the first paper plant in Spain, which came in again through the Muslim influence into the Muslim parts of Spain, where paper started to come into existence. And then 1702, the first real known fountain pen was invented, but there were a number of problems with this design. 1803, metal pens became patented in terms of pen points. And we started to get patents that started to appear in the pen market as people started to lock down this critical technology. Now, pen points are basically pieces of metal that have been formed into different shapes. And the plus is they are very durable, reliable, unlike a quill. They you know, last a little bit longer. And basically, you would fit them into a handle of some sort. Again, dip into the ink, dip and write, dip and write. And this was actually the main type of pen used well up until the ballpoint pen became popular, because fountain pens were used in a lot of cases, but fountain pens have always been fairly expensive devices. So when you go into a bank, even into the 1940s and 50s, there would actually be dip nib pens out because a fountain pen was too expensive to leave out. So this was really one of the mainstays up, and also is the first time we started to see pens being produced in a industrialized fashion. So we'll move on. We had you know, fountain pens continue to grow. 1884, L.E. Waterman designed the first really working fountain pen. He used a famous three-feeder model and spoon feeders, which allowed ink to consistently flow down to the paper and provided very consistent results. And actually, in 1888, the first patent was issued for a ballpoint pen, but it was actually designed to write on leather opposed to on paper and never really became commercially viable. 1890, one of the first big improvements came with fountain pens with safety pens, and this gets back to the goal-based issue of these pens actually had features in them to prevent leaking, because it was very you know, difficult to have a fountain pen in terms of if it would leak on stuff. You know, that could obviously harm the end user's use of the technology. So this is the first invention of safety pens. Now, with fountain pens, there are a variety of ways that they can actually be filled up, and there are four major systems. This whole thing, I could probably spend just a whole hour talking about different filler systems that are present, but be known that there are different types of filler systems that are out there that have evolved over the years. The ones that remain today are pretty much the two bottom ones, the piston pneumatic system for filling up fountain pens. And yeah, key thing, I mean, for people in here that are not as into pens culture as I am, you know, may not realize that, you know, when you get into the finer pens, the pen and the ink are actually separate items. And this will become critical later on when we talk about testing processes, of needing to have testing processes that can test both the ink and the pen qualities and how they interact. Big improvement occurred in the 1920s. This is really when reliable, portable, and self-contained fountain pens emerged onto the market, and fountain pens really became a reliable writing implement. 1930s, the first cartridge-filled pens came out. Pens before with fountain pens, you had to actually put them into the inkwell, do some sort of filling mechanism to fill them up with ink. The cartridge pens, they had separate cartridges. You just basically pop in this cartridge, and that's where you get the ink from. The first ones were actually glass, designed to be disposable. And they were made by the JAF Waterman Company, and that's actually the French division of the world-famous Waterman Company in the U.S., which is really instrumental in early pen design. During 1939, the first working ballpoint pen was for paper use was invented by the Biro brothers. And in 1940, the Biro fountain pen was patented. Shortly after that, actually, it was purchased by the UK government for the war effort, because one thing that fountain pens provided and really gave the Allies an edge in the war is old fountain pens would not work in unpressurized aircraft, especially at high altitudes. Yes? I do not, but I could, I'd be happy to try to look that up. And basically, during, you know, older times, the in unpressurized aircraft, a fountain pen would not work well, or during pressure changes, the ink may not flow well, may blot. But the Allies had a huge advantage using these fountain pens that were usable at all altitudes and inside pressurized cabins. So that gave the Allies a huge advantage over the Axis powers by being able to reliably write and record information while in flight. 1943, the first commercially available fountain pens were available. During the late 1940s, the price dropped down to 50 cents per pen, which at the time was still expensive, but not as much as you know, $100 or so. Yes? Before then, it was around the 125 mark, which is still pretty reasonable. But when you got down to 50 cents, it became much more cheaper. Basic math. That is actually not an adjusted dollar, so it's still a fairly expensive item, but not compared to fountain pens or other things that were much more expensive. Yeah. Yeah, come on! More expensive-er, yes. And then 1950s, actually, a French baron dropped the H from his name, formed a Bic pen company, which was a huge invention, a huge development, basically. But at the end of the 1950s, the ballpoint phase, I'll actually ask to have questions held to the end just to make sure we cover everything. And I'll be up in the breakout session to review things. You know, maybe we can get out some demos and try some stuff out hands-on. Statements? Let's pop a pen. Yeah. See enough of your stickers around already. So the 1951, the fountain pen really actually temporarily died because of real quality issues. 1954, ballpoint pen came out in big force with the Parker Jotter. In this case, prices again dropped in terms of these are relativistic dollars, or no, these are actual dollars at the time, but still cheaper than digital ones. Move forward, at this point we start to see the big pen company actually start to overtake pen manufacturers, and this shows the rise of the fountain pen over, or rise of the ballpoint pen over the fountain pen. We had things such as the modern felt tip pen was introduced, Fisher release or pressurized space pen, 1967, pens made it into space. It's part of the NASA project. Before then it was grease pencils or pencils. We then had the early introduction of porous point pens, which most people refer to as drafting pens, so things like Microns and those type of pens. 1979, big development in the ink area, erasable pens came out. Move on, we have developments such as the jelly pens, the Uniball 207, which is the first pen that prevents check washing. So as you can see in this fragmented pen market today, repeatable and measurable pen testing standards are even more important as things have just diverged so much. So with that, I'll take a step back and we'll talk about what are some of the existing pen standards. There are ISO standards that presently exist for pens. Before I did this research, I did not actually know there are actually ISO standards for pens and testing pens. We have ones for tubular tip pens, such as drafting pens, and they actually have procedures for testing these pens. There's also standardized vocabulary. There are additional ISO standards that get into things like ballpoint pens, gel pens, and rollerball pens. But again, the issue here is we have these different standards for different technologies. So it's really difficult using the ISO standards to compare a ballpoint pen to a rollerball pen. So our goal here is to help bridge that gap. I'm still actually digging into those. And yes, I'll say we'll hold the questions. So we'll now move into pen rating systems, systems you can use to rate pens as you as you work on them. The first one is Optave, and this is the operational pen testing. Pen testing and value equation. It was developed by PERT, the pen evaluation and rating team out of Pittsburgh. This system, you develop scenarios and then evaluate the pens against them. It is a qualitative approach to pen testing and really focuses on the operational values of pens, such as the reliability and total cost of ownership. Of course, there's the PEAR model, which focuses on which is the pen and ink rating system. And the big thing that PEAR introduces is the ability to actually rate the pen and ink together, since those are critical items. And this takes more of a qualitative approach. As you can see, we have a nice little flow chart here where you can flow down through the different characteristics and qualitatively measure the results. Those are kind of two competing standards. But really, all pen rating systems have one problem. The tester cannot provide reliable and repeatable results. So because of this, you still, garbage in, garbage out. We can't really get to the point where we're debating pen rating systems if we can't provide reliable data into those systems. So it's key that, again, we come up with a standard system here. So with this, I propose a line we can draw. The starting of a pen testing standard. First, the test process. First is paper selection. And with this, we wanted to standardize on paper types or different weights of paper. We decided to go with 20-pound online white paper. And we wanted to go with 20-pound because that way you can do the test, flip it over, see what sort of leakage occurs onto the other side. And since 20-pound is the most common type of paper used in an office environment, it allowed to detect if leakage was occurring through the paper. You also want a medium tooth, which is the actual roughness of the paper. And medium tooth, again, is a good standard in terms of being able to test a variety of different pens. And actually, higher tooth paper can cause some problems with fountain pens, and then a lower tooth paper can cause problems with things like ballpoint pens, which can actually get proper rolling friction. So we went with medium tooth there to standardize that. And the other key is to have even weight distribution. When you get into cheaper paper, this is something where you look at stuff like Moleskine books that have come into popularity in the U.S. The weight distribution on them is actually uneven. So if you start writing with a fountain pen at the top of the page, it'll look wonderful. When you get down to the bottom of the page, the weight has actually dropped a little bit, and you'll start to get splattering and splotching as it spreads out. So it's really key to make sure you have consistent weight across the paper, so a test at the top has the same results at the bottom. Because again, if the medium is changing, that could provide difficulties for the tester in making sure you're producing consistent results. So the general pen testing process, uncap the pen, draw 5 parallel lines 4 inches long in rapid succession, recap the pen, and analyze the results. So let's look at some of the analysis that occurs. You want to rate each of these four areas on a scale from 1 to 10. And we are actually developing rating guides. They'll provide very consistent results on what a 1 is, 2, 3, 4, 5, and all the way up through 10. Again, to make sure that one tester, two testers looking at the same test results or testing the same pen will get the same results. So you look at things like continuity. Is the line a solid line? Are there any breaks? Is it a smooth line? Is there any initial blot? On some pens, when you first put down the pen, you get a heavier ink, and then it moves into a line. Are there any end blots where at the end you pull it up and is there, you know, heavy blotting at the end? End blots are something you'll notice with things like Microns, other disposable drafting pens. And then there's also width consistency. Is the width of the pen line consistent across the board? So any discussion of pen testing would not be complete without talking about automated pen testing systems. Of course, there's the famous one for its price and first on the market, Pure Impact. There's the MetaWrite project, open source tool set with its awesome image. And then, of course, they've started to commercialize it with the MetaWrite Express and MetaWrite Pro, as they offer more GUI-based hands-on capabilities to the pen testing framework. Now, my wife and I have been working on something, and we have invented our own automated pen testing system here. And this is the first prototype of it. Later on, we'll be selling t-shirts online with this design if anybody wants to get an automated pen tester to wear around with pride. So with that, we'll now go into some case studies. With this, we look at the Aurora fountain pen. It's a lower-end fountain pen, has a steel nib, so it provides inexpensive pen production. Most of the nicer pens have a gold plate nib on them, or a solid gold nib, or a platinum nib. So this is a cheaper pen. And we'll go and look at the test results. So as you can see, color consistency is weak across the board. We do see heavier blotting at the end as you pick up the pen, and some bleeding that occurs even on a medium tooth paper, which could imply that the ink is not being applied properly. Sure. How does tester error? User error, yeah, and that's something that we're still working on, but as we start to do this, we have a large testing community. We're starting to fan out the results to then compare what the results are to then figure out ways to improve upon that, because that is a huge concern. If you have a skilled pen tester versus an unskilled pen tester, you can often get very different results that can come out of it, especially a concern as we start to move some of the pen testing process over to outsourcing them to third world countries and other places where you get into different standards there. So that is something that we are definitely really looking at. That is possible. That is possible. I mean, you can get into problems with some of the more expensive fountain pens get rather big, and the kids really can't properly hold them. So that can be an issue there. But that is something that needs to be taken into account from a comfort point of view, because someone that has big beefy paws or a dainty person may find a pen different. And that's where we're really needing one area we haven't addressed is comfort. Yeah, I mean, how they met, yes. Yes, exactly. It usually does not, but again, this is stuff we're looking at. I mean, the key here is this is a first step down a very long road, and any long journey starts with one step. So next up, we have the Bic Rollerball, Bic Grip Roller. This is a rollerball type pen. This was a fine tip pen, 0.7 millimeter ball. And according to Bic's website, it's appropriate for home, office, and school use. Could be. So here we have the different results. Again, over here we have a break in the line, some blotting that's occurring at the end, but fairly consistent line composure in terms of color and other items, with the pen usage itself. I believe this is our final example, the Lamy Safari fountain pen, which is again a steel tip pen, medium nib. And in this case, we are using Aurora 5 ink inside of it. This pen, the ink is separate. So depending on the ink you use, it can also impact the performance of the pen. So here we have this, and I mean, the results here are pretty telling. Very, very weak line drawing, lots of bleed over. You know, some of the stuff at the end, you're starting to get some color consistency, but it's also starting to blot up. So, you know, really, you know, pretty telling, pretty much says it all. So with that, conclude with, as I mentioned before, any journey starts with a single step. This is the first step down a long road to generating consistent and measurable pen testing results. And I am touched that as many people came out to see this. I've been uplifted by how big the pen testing community is in terms of people that do it and are looking to get into it. So I'm really happy to see, especially the younger generation getting involved, to make sure that this art is not lost. And as we take this art and move it into a science, we can then provide reproducible results that can be of value to our customers. Yes.
Have inferior pens, and they are hiding the end blot failures in the serifs.
Well, that would be a mitigation technique to be able to mitigate the risk of a poorly produced pen. So, I mean, that can be if the business is accepting that risk of using that type of font style and is willing to provide training to their staff. Because the key thing there that also gets into the ease of use is if you need to then provide additional training to the staff. If you know you have a pen that costs $1 and then a pen that costs 50 cents, but you need to train your staff how to do serif fonts, then you're going to be getting into, you know, potentially the total cost of ownership would be less just to go to higher quality pen.
So Mick and I are wondering, with all this pen testing, are there black cap pen testers?
That is an interesting idea. Now, when you get into, I don't really want to get into the whole white ink, black ink, red ink, purple ink, you know, gel with the glittery ink discussions. I prefer not to judge a pen tester by the color of the ink they use. I prefer to judge them by the results of their testing and if they can produce consistent and reliable results.
So Matt, how have you had to adjust your pen test methodology for the private sector versus government clients?
Yeah, it was actually interesting. A lot of the early tests I was looking at with government sector, like most things, I mean, there's the NIST 63.12 standard that outlined pen testing requirements for government organizations, but they were focused on steel nib pens, which, you know, haven't really been in existence since the, you know, 1950s. So in typical government standards, the standards they're using to test their pens are really not appropriate to the modern day pen. So there had to have been some adjustments made there. And I'm hoping some of these methodologies can flow back into the government sector to provide value there to make sure that, you know, we are you know, producing results that are also useful in the government sector.
So one thing that's a little concerning is that the in the your pen testing framework that you're proposing, I don't see altitude playing a large role.
That's actually a very good point. That is something that, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up to this community is we are a community of you know, smart individuals that have a passion for pens. So, you know, there are going to be things that have been missing initial standards, and altitude is definitely a very good one. As I was discussing before with the problems with fountain pens in unpressurized cabins and other areas, altitude can definitely impact the performance of the pen. So we'll need to add in some requirements around relative barometric pressure in the room, and you know, to make sure that the pens are being tested consistently, and potentially generate standards for high altitude testing, unpressurized cabin testing, and other types of areas. I do have some Freedom of Information request out to NASA to see if they have any specific pen testing requirements around pens in space. They do have a nice page up about the history of the Fisher space pen, but they don't really get into the testing methodology they used to select that pen for their use in the space program. Yes?
I have the microphone. Okay, so I'm genuinely concerned, actually. You're leading this pen testing effort, correct?
I'm one of the folks involved. I'd say I'm one of the, you know, we're a community effort.
You're a figurehead. You're there in front. Two notes. One is I don't think people in this room are taking it seriously enough. I a pox on you all. A serious question, as one of the members of the community involved in pen testing, are you concerned or even evaluating the weaponizing of these systems? And I speak specifically about the Shiv and Zip Gun contingent.
Yeah, I mean, anytime when you have a technology you love and you see it used to harm or hurt other people, it definitely strikes at your heart. And that is one thing where, you know, I like to provide these results as information. I hold many workshops on teaching people how to use pens, proper use of pens, and I just hope they'll take that knowledge and use it in an appropriate manner, you know, not to harm other people. But, you know, there are going to be people out there that may take that approach, and, it saddens me when it occurs, but I try not to let that discourage me from spreading the wonderful information there is about pens. Thank you.
Wait,
oh yeah, we got a half an hour left. We're good.
So, Matt, you know, I'm glad that you're bringing light to this important subject, and I was wondering if you could speak about some of the integrity checking that happens in the ISO process to make sure that the assessment is even from test to test to, you know, say avoid an instance where an assessor does a checklist very quickly. Pencil whips the audit, if you will.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, I don't like to use the P word, but that does occur. That does occur. And it's interesting. It's really the testing, when they talk about integrity in the ISO standards, they're not as much looking at integrity of the test itself, which is one of the issues I'm trying to resolve. They're mainly looking at the archivability and the security of the ink itself, in terms of, will the ink, you know, that's used on a government document still be legible and readable 50, 100 years down the road. So when you talk about integrity, it's important to define those terms, because in the government sector and with the ISO standards, they're talking about the archive quality of the ink, not the integrity of the test. And that again, is just one of the problems there of, you can have somebody which, does not do the test properly. And in that case, I mean, you could have, you know, government organization that purchases pens that don't have proper archive capabilities, and 50 years from now we go look at their documents and they're faded. I mean, that's history that's lost.
Hey Matt, do you have any interesting or inspiring words of wisdom to new and upcoming pen testers?
I do. There's it's a broad world out there, and community is very important. Glad to see we have a community here, not a confined place for people that can combine the art and technology of pens together into one area. For folks that are interested in this, I recommend to get more involved in the community. There's the Central Ohio Pen Show that takes place in the second weekend in October, which is one of the larger pen shows in the country, right down in Columbus. If you go down there, you can see lectures devoted to pens, pen culture, and really get involved. You'll find it's a very caring, giving community, and when you do get involved, when you give a little, a lot will be given back to you.
Hey, Matt, I have a question.
Yes,
so
Dave.
What do you want from us as a community? How can we help you improve this standard and help you? Because obviously it sounds like as the start of this project, there would be a follow-up to this. So what could we do to help you with that follow-up?
Excellent question. And as I mentioned, any journey starts with a single step. Multiple hands makes a heavy load lighter. So, the more we can pull in people to do testing, review these standards, the better it is. So once we come up with solid standards, we'll then need to have people to go out and spread the word and properly train people on how to do this test to make sure that all corners of the world know how to properly test pens, and we can provide those consistent and measurable results across the board.
Matt, I know there's a lot of controversy among the community. I want to know, where do you draw the line between a pen test and a pencil assessment?
I've pretty much stayed out of the pencil and marker. Marker testing, and actually the marker testing, a huge debate on our mailing list is right now where to draw the line between a marker and a felt tip pen, because they definitely have similarities. And we're still actually fighting out, where does a marker start and where does a felt tip pen begin? Luckily, pencils are a fairly easy area to draw that line, and we basically have left the pencil testing problem to another community to take up.
Yes. When you're talking about testing pens and how that works out, there has to be some kind of adjustments. How do you guarantee things like the viscosity of the ink?
Yeah, and that's where you get into, there'll probably be separate standards that come out for looking at the ink as well. If we go back, let's see, to the pair equation, One key thing about the pair equation is that it is pen and ink rating, and they actually break down the line into two separate testing areas, one side for the pen, one side for the ink, because definitely getting into things like, especially pens that are refillable, the that adds a whole other variable in terms of the viscosity of the ink, the archive quality ink, the smoothness of the ink, and then how that ink interacts with that pen as well. Because depending on the feeder system that the pen has, which is a system that carries the ink from the reservoir down to the tip, different types of ink may work better or worse with that particular pen. So that really brings into play a lot of the concerns there. And Pear is working on this, but it's still being used. And Jim Jones, who invented Pear, actually up in town at Progressive Insurance to try to provide reproducible results there, has really been fighting this battle. And it's definitely something where I don't have a solid answer, but something we're committed to finding an answer to.
This project is a great step forward, but have you already started looking into outreach for pen development firms, maybe the open source pen projects?
Well, I've reached out to the American Pen Makers Association, which is an industry trade group that exists and has been heavily involved in making the ISO standards. Sadly, because they've been involved in the ISO standards, they kind of are fully invested in those standards and have been a little resistant to that. So we're hoping to build up some mass. But as you're talking about outreach programs, we have had a very good inner city outreach program in terms of pen education and pen testing standards to be able to train up the future generation again to provide pen testing results. So with this, I think we'll have a couple more questions and we'll break. But three more questions. Perfect. Go for it.
I'm number one.
I got the mic.
I do want to volunteer. I don't have much in the way of technical ability.
Oh, but your comments have just been amazing throughout the talk. It's been great to see your support.
I agree. but I would like to say, as a web developer, Mike and I, we both work for FARC. We'd like to open up server space, and we think that we can help you with like an ICANN or DCMA for Pen is Mightier. We can get you that.
Oh, that would be awesome. If you do that, we can find content to fill up that site and make it a central point of travel on the internet. So that would be wonderful. We'd love to talk to you more about that. Pen Island, that's good as well. Or you're doing it right. Pen testing, that's probably taken. But anyways, yes.
I don't want to say anything bad about pens. I really like the work you're doing, but I did notice in your talk you failed to address the whiteout exploit.
Anytime you start talking about pens or pen testing and you get into zero-day research or other disruptive technologies, that can open a whole other can of worms. As far as the whiteout testing goes, that can affect some of the ISO standards in terms of archivability of the pen, but doesn't really impact the use of the pens, although an interesting area with rollerball specifically, you actually need to be very careful when writing over whiteout because rollerballs have a much thinner ink and a ball that's easier moving, and it's very easy when writing over whiteout to actually have that clog the pen. So there could be some further testing there in terms of anti-pen clogging abilities that can be caused by whiteout, but as far as the ability to, alter documents and stuff, that really falls into other key areas there. Any sort of exploit or zero-day attack against pens is of a concern. That's kind of further down the road to make sure they want to be taken care of in a standard, but for today, we're really focused on just getting repeatable, consistent results. Then we'll look at the unknown that's on the horizon.
Matt, as a college student, I'm learning a lot about pens, and actually your talk has really opened my eyes.
Excellent.
Where do I start? Where do I continue from here?
Well, we have a mailing list. It looks like the nice gentlemen back are going to offer to help us set up a website. We do offer internship programs to help gain those valuable skills for being able to do the testing and get hands-on experience in the field. Because as anybody knows, you know, the college education is wonderful. It's definitely great to have. But having that hands-on knowledge can really be the edge up to get the job in the competitive pen testing industry. With that, we have one more question. And then we'll wrap it up.
So, Matt, I might be, kind of the outlier here, but where do you see digital signatures going with this?
Well, we embrace changes in technology. As we went through, the history of the pen, it is one that's really focused on technology and technological advancements. From the advent of the early reed pens up through, you know, pressurized space pens that can work in a zero atmosphere, we have embraced the use of technology in pens. Presently, some amazing pen research is going on in Japan, where that's really become the forefront of pen technology. That's where the jelly pens were originally introduced, just about 10 years ago. And digital signatures, we feel, you know, there's definitely a place for them. We think that people that are going to like the use of pens, people seem to like the use of paper books, which are, I mean, they're kind of like e-readers, but they have these pages, and they seem to be pretty popular among people that like the hands-on tactile feel. So with that, I'd like to say thank you very much for coming out. I really appreciate your time.
Mr. Neely will be available.